spring, and so the circle is a lot tighter. Beneath the whirlpool, the water still spins, but the water pressure is too great to allow any airspace at all. This moment of science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Brabson Foundation. Today's program was prepared by Don Ulin, and I'm Don Glass.
Now let's take a look at sports news. Jeff Samardzija has been optioned to AAA Iowa after being hit hard in his first major league start for the Chicago Cubs last night. Chicago also recalled right-hander Justin Berg from Iowa today. The Cubs are hoping to salvage the finale of a three-game series with Philadelphia this afternoon at Wrigley Field. Four straight losses have dropped the Cubs four games behind St. Louis in the National League Central. Chicago has some work ahead of itself this afternoon. In the bottom of the fourth, the Phillies lead the Cubs 4-0. The first-place St. Louis Cardinals have the day off. They begin a series with San Diego tomorrow night at Busch Stadium. Oakland is the next stop on the road trip for the Chicago White Sox. The Sox have a weekend series against the Athletics beginning tomorrow night. They're off today. In golf and rugby, might be included in the 2016 Summer Olympics, but baseball and softball will not be. The International Olympic Committee Executive Board today narrowed the field of proposed sports to two from a list of seven. They also rejected squash, karate, and roller sports. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Blood donation takes only 45 minutes and saves lives. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
It's 2:42. A great debate is on about health care reform in America, but this is not the first time the nation has grappled with the issue. Rich Egger has more.
Keith Bockelman says as long ago as the late 1800s, some members of Congress pushed for a national health program. They wanted to emulate the European social welfare system. Bockelman is with Western Illinois University's Political Science Department. He says that initial attempt was obviously unsuccessful, as have been subsequent attempts.
Back in the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt passed the Social Security Act, there were some in Congress who wanted to include a national health care system as part of that. Roosevelt, in fact, opposed that because he felt that it would bring the whole bill down, and so he worked against that. Then there were various efforts in the 40s and 50s. President Truman supported a national health care bill, and then there were various efforts in Congress during this time, again, all unsuccessful. In 1965, President Johnson was successful in getting Medicare and Medicaid through Congress, and so that covered a lot of people, older people, the poor who had not been covered up to that time or were tended to receive less coverage. And then, of course, in the 90s, there was the Clinton health care effort, which attempted to provide universal coverage, which failed. And so here we are again today kind of debating this again, and we'll see what happens.
What usually ends up being the roadblock? For example, you mentioned Truman tried and was not able to get a bill through. What was the roadblock there?
Well, some of the earlier efforts have been opposed by doctors. That has changed now. The doctors are not so opposed to it currently. But in the earlier incarnations, there was a lot of opposition by the doctors. And this larger sense that this would be socialism or something like that, which we still hear today. So some of the same things today and then some different things also.
Well, we hear that word socialism a lot, but don't we have national public education? We have national highway system. You could go on and on with a list of national programs. What makes healthcare seem so different?
Well, I think that people probably don't think of these other things that way. I think socialism is kind of a buzzword. You know, of course, Medicare would be socialized medicine as well, and most people who are on it support that. So I think, you know, it's a scary term, and I think it's an effective term in generating opposition. But I think people probably don't link up the fact that, you know, of course, the government's involved in many things that could be considered socialism in one aspect or another.
Have the opponents of health reform remained the same over the years, or are there different groups lobbying against it today as compared to past efforts?
in the past, say going back to the 30s and 40s, the doctors were really more important as a source of opposition. The private health insurance system was not as developed as it is today. And now I think the last two go-arounds with the Clinton plan and the current efforts by President Obama to get health care, it's really more the private insurance companies who are afraid they'll be put out of business by it. And so the opposition comes more from them than from the doctors.
Some lawmakers wanted to get this done before their August recess. Obviously, that has not happened. Any feel for when this might happen or a feel for when we might reach a point where this has to be dropped?
I think that something will happen one way or the other in the fall. If it fails, I think what we'll see probably is more incremental efforts to probably reform some of the practices of the insurance companies that people don't like, to maybe expand incrementally who can get health insurance. You know, after the Clinton plan failed in the 90s, you had the SCHIP program, which covers children. So there were some incremental efforts to expand coverage in various ways. So if it does fail, you know, I don't think it's over completely. I think you might see these more incremental things. But I think if there's going to be a comprehensive plan, comprehensive reform, that'll either happen or not happen in the fall.
Democrats control the White House, the House, the Senate. Why has there been such a push to make this a bipartisan plan?
Well, I think President Obama is trying to, you know, keep his campaign promises, to try to change the tone of Washington, to try to work with the other side. And so from my perspective, I think he's just trying to keep his campaign promise. Again, whether this bears fruit, there's already some talk in the Senate that, you know, the Senate may have to just say, okay, look, we're going to do this with all Democrats. There are negotiations in the Finance Committee, but that may well fall apart. So I'm not sure this will be bipartisan in the end, but I think the impetus behind it was President Obama wanted to keep his campaign promise. And I think he legitimately believes that if there's more debate on this, if he can get some Republicans on his side, it'll be a better bill.
Keith Bockelman is with Western Illinois University's Political Science Department. He says early on, President Obama linked health care reform to the economy and the high cost to business. But the president has not focused on it as much lately, which might jeopardize his ability to win support for his plan. Rich Egger reporting.
When people think of songs about the environment, they think of visions of folk singers and acoustic guitars. Those may come to mind, but the environment is becoming an issue among hip-hop artists. Lester Graham reports they're looking at the issue and how it affects their lives.
Environmentalists are often portrayed as tree-hugging elitists by conservative talk show hosts and others. That image really was never accurate, but the environmental movement is becoming more diverse. Environmental issues are becoming increasingly important to a wider swath of society. Mike Cermak is a consultant for Boston's public schools. He helps teachers figure out the best ways to teach classes such as environmental science. He's come to the conclusion that music can go a long way in getting the attention of kids in the classroom, especially since hip-hop artists started tackling the environment, and not just as some distant polar bears and butterflies issue.
We really want to start at, you know, the corner store and ask deep questions like, why isn't there any fresh produce? Is that linked to the fact that diabetes and obesity are kind of rampant in our neighborhoods and in our families?
Cermak says artists such as Mos Def hit a chord with people with songs like New World Water.
Tell your crew, use the H2 and Y's amounts. It's the New World Water, and every drop counts. You can laugh and take it as a joke if you wanna, but it don't rain a full week some summers.
And it's not just those big nationally known artists. Mike Cermak says he stumbled into Boston's local green hip-hop movement by working with activists who were trying to stop a power plant from being built next to an elementary school.
In talking with them further and getting to know them, also many of them turned out to be these really talented MCs, these talented lyricists who were using the new knowledge that they found working with the nonprofits and kind of weaving those into their more traditional narratives of, this is what's wrong with, you know, street urban issues, this is what's wrong with all the gangsters around in my city. They're saying, you know, how can we also bring in these environmental issues.
And those artists are pulling in friends and bringing a whole lot of street cred to environmental issues. Tam Blessed and Ben Gilbar called in some of their Boston friends to perform Green Anthem.
Everybody shine, be solar powered, speak your mind, that's wind power.
They're staying true to their roots as kind of the voice for social injustice and speaking out against urban problems. And they're really mixing it up with a lot of environmental issues.
Mike Cermak says he's been working to get students interested in environmental issues in the classroom, but hip-hop artists, such as J Live and This One, get it done in a way students know.
They're already used to loving the hip-hop tracks, and they know the MC. You know, it's more important that the MC is from the community. That's another big piece. I think it's a really interesting start to this green hip-hop potential.
For the Environment Report, I'm Lester Graham.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
It's 2:51. Set in the Weimar Republic, fascists, communists, hookers, cowards, and a rumpled German homicide detective who's just trying to do his job are the characters that populate the detective novels of Philip Kerr. NPR's Eric Westervelt has a profile of Kerr.
Today, East Berlin's Alexanderplatz is a sprawling mass of concrete chain stores and billboards advertising toothpaste and cars. A statue of Karl Marx casts a disappointed eye over what remains of his legacy. Novelist Philip Kerr is standing outside a Berlin Alexanderplatz police station. It's here that Kerr's detective, Bernie Gunther, works his homicide beat in the 1920s and early 30s. It's hard to believe this drab expanse of East German architecture was once the physical and emotional heart of the city.
It was pure Berlin. It was vulgar. It was noisy. It was dirty. It was full of rogues and cheats and thieves, full of policemen, many of whom were rogues and thieves and cheats themselves.
Kerr's detective is witness to the rise and fall of both the Weimar Republic and the Third Reich. Gunther's city is a mix of extremes. People are flocking to fascism or communism. Berlin's trying to emerge from the shell shock of defeat in the First World War, hyperinflation, and later the stock market crash of 1929. It's also a city whiplashed by rapid modernization, where the attempted orderliness of Weimar republicanism runs smack into the excesses and debauchery of Berlin's dirty nightlife.
Berlin was in the 20s and very early 30s was the most liberal city in Europe. I mean, anything went.
Sex,
drugs, cabaret, open nudity, you name it.
That is, until the Nazis cracked down. Philip Kerr and I take to what's left of Gunther's streets on foot. We head to Linienstrasse, which today is part of the gentrified, Mercedes-lined gallery district where people in carefully ruffled attire sip cappuccinos and try to look artfully bored. The white-walled sterility of the streets betrays nothing of what the area once was. We're standing at an address that used to be home to the Blue Stocking, a notorious Weimar haunt, where some of Berlin's estimated 100,000 hookers would accommodate just about any kink, perversion, or taste. The Blue Stocking was known for hookers called Gravel.
Gravel were prostitutes who were disabled. So they either had one leg, or they were disfigured in some way, or one arm, or possibly no legs at all. It was actually quite a big market. The reason being, of course, that so many men were disabled after the First World War, that many of them really only felt confident when they were with people who were similarly disabled.
Today, the infamous club address houses a physiotherapy studio. In Kerr's novels, Detective Gunther sees the city he loves for its edgy openness slowly becoming oppressive and taken over by jackbooted thugs. Bernie believes in democracy in the Weimar Republic, yet he's not passionately political. He just wants to do his job. He's a professional. But when dead communists and Jews begin turning up on Berlin streets, it becomes impossible for Gunther to do his job because it's the fascist brown shirts who are doing most of the throat cutting and strangling. Kerr reads from March Violets in his Berlin Noir trilogy, where Gunther complains of the pressure on police to enforce the new order.
Villainies like speaking disrespectfully of the Führer, displaying a sold-out sign in your butcher's shop window, not giving the Hitler salute, and homosexuality. That was Berlin under the National Socialist government. Sinister cellars, locked rooms, and a whole attic full of poltergeists on the loose, throwing books, banging doors, breaking glass, shouting in the night, and generally scaring the owners so badly that there were times when they were ready to sell up. and get out. But most of the time, they just stopped up their ears, covered their blackened eyes, and tried to pretend there was nothing wrong. Cowed with fear, they spoke very little, ignoring the carpet moving underneath their feet, and their laughter was the thin, nervous kind that always accompanies the boss's little joke.
Kerr's detective is infused with a bit of moral ambiguity. He's opposed to the Nazis, but he doesn't always stand up to them. He is, as Kerr puts it, a survivalist, but his moral code sometimes gets in the way. Next to what's left of the Berlin Wall, at an outdoor exhibit called The Topography of Terror, we eye the red brick outlines of basement cells. It's all that's left of the Berlin Gestapo's main headquarters and prison. It's where anyone the Nazis hated, communists, Jews, dissidents, gays, social democrats, gypsies, were interrogated, tortured, and many killed.
Really, what terrifies me most is that nearly all of it was done by lawyers. These people were intelligent, urbane, articulate. They knew perfectly well what they were doing.
And if you survived Gestapo interrogation and weren't shipped off to a concentration camp, they often took you into the garden here and shot you, usually at 11 a.m. sharp, German punctuality. It was said that people who lived in the neighborhood could set their clocks by the sound of the gunfire. Kerr's detective works his beat with this kind of backdrop of terror always hovering over him.
It is certainly, for my money, the most important historical event of the millennium, really, probably since the Reformation anyway. It's no time at all since it happened. It's only 50, 60, 70 years, which is nothing in historical terms, nothing at all.
Kerr was trained as a lawyer, but quickly gave up the profession his parents wanted him to pursue and followed his passion for writing. He's published more than 20 novels so far. He says his work has stayed vibrant by staying away from the cookie-cutter formulas that often tarnish the mystery and crime genres.
It's terribly parochial. It's like small-scale stuff. It's like, well, you think, how many murders can you get in Oxford, for Pete's sake? You know. And the fascination for me about writing about crime in Berlin was the idea that there was this much bigger crime taking place in the background. You know, a fantastically epochal moment in history, which is just going on. So, you know, you've got this sense of investigating criminals, and yet the fun part for the writer is to bring in the really bad guy, and that just sort of makes the whole thing sort of have a greater resonance, really. The echo is much louder.
Bernie Gunther, Kerr's sassy, occasionally morally ambivalent detective, appears in his sixth Berlin detective novel out this fall. It's called If the Dead Rise Not. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, with Philip Kerr in Berlin.
Earth and Sky.
The more we can learn about the Arctic and the Antarctic,